from the front lines of the green rush. This is Green Entrepreneur, where business owners talk about how they found success in cannabis and how you can too. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Green Entrepreneur podcast. I'm Jonathan Small, the editor-in-chief of Green Entrepreneur. Dashita Dawson joins us on the program. Dashita Dawson is the newly appointed cannabis program supervisor for the city of Portland, Oregon. And Dashita will oversee regulations, licensing, and equity for that fine city. She is only the third Black woman in the country to hold a cannabis regulatory oversight leadership role. And prior to this new role, Dashita was an industry educator. She still is a senior executive leader and strategy expert for multiple cannabis businesses, municipalities, and media outlets across the country. She was also a frequent contributor to Green Entrepreneur. I hope you continue to be writing for us. We always love your stories. Dashita Dawson, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you, Jonathan.
So tell me how you ended up getting this job.
Well, I mean, where do I start? But to be perfectly honest, I think I got to start with my initial journey in the industry. I started in the Arizona market as a medical marijuana patient and saw a lot of challenges in the way cannabis was spoken about, taught, marketed, the supply chain, everything that you can imagine from some of my corporate experience, and jumped in and learned a ton about how both municipalities needed the appropriate regulatory structure and the private businesses needed to really understand the plant to, in order for us to see some sort of success in some of these markets. So I've been on the Oregon Cannabis Commission Governance Frameworking Subcommittee for about 8 months. And I saw that they were looking for someone to oversee the cannabis industry in Portland, Oregon, which is the largest market for the state of Oregon in terms of cannabis. And I submitted my name. I think we are under, you know, in a situation now where we really do need to have our best and our brightest, I think, working on multiple angles of cannabis legalization. And a lot of people try to go through the private sector entrepreneurial door because they think it's the most beneficial. And I've just been working the last 2 years with municipalities, and I feel like this isn't going to work unless we have more people on the inside who really understand the plant.
Right. So now you're on the inside. So tell us exactly what you'll be doing in this job, or has the job started yet?
Yes. So I've been enrolled for some time. And to be perfectly honest, it is the cannabis industry in Portland and overseeing the program that really regulates the industry. So all the licensing, compliance, and as well, social equity. Portland is one of the only, or few rather, I won't say only, because a lot of places are saying that they have social equity. We can talk about that. But they're one of the few that has a cannabis tax revenue that the city, the constituents of the city voted on to have. 3% of the tax revenue from cannabis is meant to be specifically reinvested. And so a portion of that comes into my office, and we are able to provide some social equity grant funding to organizations working in the communities most adversely affected by prohibition.
Yeah, explain social equity to our listeners who might not understand the concept behind it.
They wouldn't be the only ones, Jonathan.
Yeah, exactly.
Being perfectly frank, social equity is starting to become the term that's a little bit confusing because no one is talking about the same thing across jurisdictions, sometimes even within the same state. So the idea really is not about, I will say, a specific term or nomenclature. Equity really is in question mostly because we are looking at an industry that has largely been prohibited the last 80 plus years. And the history clearly shows the intention behind prohibition was to target specific populations. And it was successful in the propaganda, all of that. And what we found is a major portion of incarceration and even police interactions come from marijuana prohibition and the disproportionate rate in which Black and Hispanic populations are involved is just really high. So now we have a situation where it's legalized and it feels, in my opinion, like common sense to think that if we're going to build an industry, we have an opportunity to rebuild the communities that were torn apart as a result of it being wrongfully prohibited. And I believe that a lot of states did not consider that when it was initially started. And so we've gotten a really far head start on intentionally leaving out some of these same populations. And now I think there's a big push for us to intentionally put in the populations. The fact of the matter is that even in the legacy, unregulated, unlicensed market, we know that it's a diverse market and it's one of the community. And so we have to figure out how to make that transition. So social equity is the way some states and jurisdictions are setting it up. I'm not sure I want to call it that because I do think it's starting to get a rap of sort of the new affirmative action. And the reality is we really just want to restore communities. We need to provide restitution to families and individuals that have been incarcerated as a result of this. And we need to reinvest in building up the businesses and communities that were destroyed as a result.
In your bio, you said that marijuana prohibition has played a role in your life, which intrigued me. In what way? Has it had a direct impact on your own life as a Black woman?
Yeah, sure. So I grew up in East New York, Brooklyn. And I think in that way, that's what makes me an interesting individual or leader in the industry, because I'm the intersectionality of everything. It's like quite fascinating. But I'm from what was considered the murder capital of the country at some point in the 80s and 90s due to the quote unquote war on drugs. The two things I remember most growing up around that time in Brooklyn are the sounds of police sirens and gunshots. It was kind of like cops and robbers, shoot them up. And to be honest, these are memories that start from very young, 5 and 6 years old. And I think it's part of what's made me have my toughness. And I appreciate the fact that I'm from Brooklyn. I will shout that out all the time.
I knew that's why I loved you. I'm from New York as well. So.
Oh, okay. Sounds
great. I lived in Brooklyn Heights, which is pretty different than East New York, though, I will admit that.
Yes, even now.
Yes.
Even now. I mean, East New York still has its challenges as a result of it being over policed. East New York, Brownsville area in particular. And there's a lot of advocacy work on the ground there now. But at the time, I really feel, looking back as now a 41-year-old woman, I know we were over policed. And young kids, I have also a 16, almost 17-year-old young Black male son, and like kids younger than him, really harassed, and mostly as it relates to a smell, right? Most of the encounters are related to smell. And it's not just the cops smelling it. Neighbors smell weed and they're going to call the cops because they think something bad's happening. And I think that it was a really clear tool that was used to harass, detain, and then search, break civil liberties and civil rights, haul away, arrest young men. I'm talking about 12 to 18 is where it starts. And then once you get inside prison, even Rikers, just the horror stories of people coming back. And I have family members that this has happened. It's just, you're different, you change, and you come back with that mentality. And so a lot of the prison mentality, in my opinion, was on the streets of East New York, Brooklyn, because so many of the kids that were running the streets, you know, they had at points had time being locked up and usually related to cannabis. I was very straight and narrow, so I can't say that directly. I literally had no desire because it was just a fear. In fact, it's a lot of PTSD. I still don't really like the smell, and that I know where it comes from now. And so I'm very intelligent. I can articulate it and I can defend it. But I do feel that that's what we have to overcome. And not enough people have done that, specifically within communities of color. And that's why the legal market is suffering. It's like consumers, at Target, never did we ever have to be concerned about our consumer or customer leaving and potentially being arrested or targeted simply because they left our establishment. And that's a reality even in legal markets, or at least the fear. So yeah, I think for me, I'm very clear on how it has been damaging psychologically and financially and realistically for our families are concerned.
So growing up with that kind of that PTSD that came from the smell and seeing all the impact that marijuana had on your community, but you did turn to it as medicine, right? So how did that come about?
Yeah, many, many years, even decades later. So fast forward to 2012, I'm now in a pretty successfully started at Target, and my mom is suffering from cancer and she lives with me, going to Mayo Clinic. And actually Minnesota at this time is not a medical marijuana market, actually had not legalized yet. But my mom was a lifelong smoker. So that's the other thing, juxtaposed to what we saw as, you know, kids, people getting taken down, quiet as it's kept in our families and our home barbecues, the adults, the very successful, the very influential, and the very responsible adults still consumed cannabis, right? So that was something that I just remember that she called it her medicine forever. And it really then became medicine when she was in the middle of chemo. And so sourcing it for her and trying to figure that out was, you know, just a lot. And at one point, I got to deal with my own autoimmune issues. They started to really flare up in negative 25 degree weather to a point where I just was not able to move. And, you know, it was my mom's suggestion for me to consume with her. And I did. And that was my first time consuming with her, not first time ever. I had done vacations and things like that, but I was not like the person who was using all the time. And so, yeah, I did. It was a lovely experience because I got to do it. My mom is still something that stands out. She's no longer with us. But at the end of the day, it was eye-opening for me that I needed to put a different lens on it. I had only looked at it really as something my mom did and that, oh, if you have cancer. But once I started putting on my molecular biology hat, it just changed my perspective. But it didn't change that it didn't come out the closet. I was still a Black woman in a corporate position. I did not want to risk that at all. And it wasn't until she died in 2016 that I was like, you know what, this is, I love what I do, but there isn't enough skin in the game for this amount of energy I put into these corporate positions and roles. And that's how I found, I feel like, my time in cannabis as far as the legal industry is concerned.
So you weren't really working in the cannabis space up until about 2016?
Yes.
Yeah, that's amazing. I didn't realize you were that new to the business, so to speak. And here you are running the entire cannabis program supervisor in Portland. That's pretty amazing trajectory. So tell me a little bit about how the social equity program works. And it's not the only thing I want to talk to you about, but I am curious, in the city of Portland, do people send you applications? How do you vet the recipients of this 3% tax that has gone to your office?
So just to be clear, the 3% tax is split up and a portion of it gets to be put in the social equity grant fund. We're working on that. To be honest, there's a lot of conversation. The coalitions on the ground have really pushed for the cannabis tax revenue, as well as the council cannabis tax revenue, to be reallocated, because a good percentage of it, almost 80%, was going to the police department. And so, as you can imagine, this is all extremely relevant to what's happening right now in the crime for police departments to be defunded. But I, without speaking on defunding, I feel very clearly that if we have revenue that's coming from cannabis legalization and regulated cannabis, then we should be using that revenue as much as possible to ensure that the communities and the people and the individuals that suffered under prohibition get some sort of restitution and restoration. I was shocked to see this. And so I hope that it's an eye-opener for other jurisdictions to take a look at what's going on with their cannabis tax revenue and consumers specifically to ask about that. But we've been able to get upwards this year, almost $600,000 from that tax revenue to be able to provide to organizations that are supporting these communities. So it's not your typical, in this case, the fund isn't necessarily for if you want to start a dispensary. We've got some resources for that. And I'm excited to build that even more. But this is for, just that I think about, if we go back to me being from East New York, this is for the community-based organizations that were started but starving for funding, having workforce initiatives that are already created, re-entry programs, expungement programs. So we are not reinventing the wheel. And not a lot of organizations actually are doing so. And I think coming from the hood, I just know that that's not the case. Every city has a hood. Every hood has organizations that are not getting enough funding, and for various reasons. And so this grant fund is really for some of those organizations, as well as community institutions, colleges, and such that are interested in supporting rebuilding these communities. And I'm excited because it's looking like we may be able to continue to expand this program. But that's just one part of equity, and it's, you know, kind of the initial give back. I think we have so much more that needs to be done. And that's the vision I have for the city of Portland. Because if it started with this seed, I think there's an ability to grow immensely and to be a great leading force in the country as to how this, you know, actually gets done.
Right. So I'm not in Portland, I'm in Los Angeles. And I know the sort of challenges that a lot of cannabis companies have down here. And I'm wondering if it's similar in Portland. And you've probably talked to some of your colleagues in other cities that are dealing with some of these issues. But one of the big issues, of course, in LA is the illicit market. And I always hear from people in the business here that, you know, they wish that Citi had more control over the illicit market because it really undercuts legal market. And I'm wondering if that's a similar problem in Portland. Is that something that you have to contend with up there?
I think every market has to contend with the legacy illicit illegal market. I mean, I stopped calling it black market because I felt like it was a little bit almost this connotation that is somehow inherently bad. Yeah, it's bad for the legal market's supply and demand. But I also think that part of the challenge is most legal markets were built and regulations formed pretending that the legacy market doesn't exist. As a person who's a businesswoman, I just can't. It's a real economy with real supply and demand. If you look at New York, for example, where we're from, it's considered to be the largest legacy market in the world. There's no way with the way the legal market has been currently set up that that market will ever compete without acknowledging first that there's one that exists right now that you can order on an app and it has, you know, all the technologies one would expect and so on and so forth. I think that's a big miss. So I won't be doing the same. I think it's important for us to acknowledge that there is a legacy market. It's important for us to ensure that that market is decriminalized and those individuals are called into the table in terms of how do you actually become a licensed business. There are not enough trajectories that make sense in a lot of markets, but with Portland and Oregon in general being more of an open market, meaning not a cap on the number of licenses, it actually presents the best opportunity to do that. When you know you're only going for one of 10 or even one of 70, the capping is a little confusing, especially when I advise so many municipalities. I just clearly see they don't really understand flower yield. They don't really understand consumer dynamics on shopping behavior. All the things that I got to learn and really become an expert at Target and at Victoria's Secret all apply here. But that means you got to understand the legacy market. So yeah, I do. I worked in California. I see the struggle, but I also think the regulatory framework has created some of that struggle. And then also not really convincing people in the legalization movement around cannabis as medicine first. More than 60% of the municipalities in California opted out of having businesses. And so people have these dry areas where they have to drive 30 minutes, 25 minutes to get to a dispensary. And it's not necessarily the best product either in terms of what the assortment is. A lot of those groups in 2018, they were unfortunately regulated out of the market. So I could list all of the things in California as like, okay, let's not do this.
That's what I'm thinking. Like you could just don't do this, right? You can see it's the biggest market.
I think it starts with having an open market.
Yeah. Well, what are the challenges that you face? Like what are some of Portland's biggest challenges that you hope to overcome? What do you hear people complaining to you about, you know, in the legal market?
That's a great question, Jonathan. I think the biggest challenge right now, and I've actually been shocked by it, is that it's one of the longer standing legal markets as far as medical use. And yet the medical market is so tiny in terms of its penetration. About 2% of the population that actually could qualify actually do have cards. And that is very telling of what the mindset is in the state and in the communities within Portland. There's a lot of what they call cannaphobia. And so one of the first things that I'm definitely going to be looking to roll out is a re-education initiative. And I think under the guidance of our cannabis policy oversight team, which is an advisory body that comes from the community, the cannabis community within Portland specifically, doctors, as well as business owners, I think we have an opportunity to create some baseline re-education that's not just for the everyday consumer, but it's just for the everyday community member. And just my experience across the country, I understand what some of the most ridiculous misconceptions are, and they still hold even in legal markets. And to assume that they don't, just because maybe a certain demographic has at least perpetuated that, oh, this is Potland, not Portland. Fact of the matter is it has similar issues within neighborhoods, similar perspective as the municipalities that opted out in California. So all of that is a function of lack of true understanding that cannabis is medicine first and always, whether you're using it as a medical patient or in an adult use capacity.
That's interesting. So education is a huge part of your agenda there.
Absolutely.
What is the cannaphobia? I love that term. I haven't heard it. What is the cannaphobia in Portland? You think people in Portland are really, I mean, that's Portlandia. That's like the most progressive, right community almost in America. What are people in Portland? What's their canophobia?
Well, I think that sometimes super progressiveness can be a mask for what is maybe a lot of underlying microaggressions. And we can't forget sort of the history of Oregon and Portland as far as Black and Indigenous populations are concerned. And so that's something that I think their ideology is spot on and right, and that there needs to be change. And I can tell that Portlanders want to change it. I just don't think that we are necessarily have seen full action there. And in canophobia world, I really feel that it comes from, again, thinking about the most ridiculous stereotypes that come with being someone who consumes cannabis. It's either, yo, the hippie perspective, or you're a pothead, or a stoner, or, you know, which is why I love taking on the moniker, the weed head, this idea from a hip hop perspective that you ain't about anything. And that couldn't be far more incorrect. The fastest growing legal users are actually women and people 55 and over, and largely women of color, for various ailments and medicinal issues. And I think there's a new face of cannabis, one that continues to hide when there's canophobia. And we need to make it to, you know, be easier for us to all coexist, because there's a lot more consumers than people realize. It's your neighbor.
Talk to me a little bit about the business, because you've also been on that side of things. What are you seeing as a sort of like upcoming sort of trends in cannabis, the cannabis industry? Are you seeing anything even nationally and also just locally? Are you starting to see some interesting new trends?
Sure. Well, I mean, it doesn't surprise me that cannabis education is one of the fastest growing sectors. I mean, when we got stuck in our homes for 3 months, I think it really has transformed what people are wanting to share and do. Whereas maybe you're out and about traveling a lot, you can't be on your social media. Influencers and leaders in the industry have kind of turned to that. Also, to be honest, when you have things like Greenflower Media closing on investment deals, we get precedent in a sector that we haven't had in the past. And so to me, that is a big opportunity. And maybe that's also why I already know I need to deal with it in Portland. And I've been saying that for some time. But I also think that some of the bigger opportunities down the pipe will really stem around how people understand hemp and its relation to it, you know, being in a cannabis community. What I still say, hemp is the long money. And there's so many people who are just so hell-bent on focusing on what is sexy about marijuana and missing an opportunity to grow their paper with a real easy access hemp business to start. And I'm excited that Oregon already has a pretty robust program with, I believe, OSU. And I think the third thing that I'm constantly talking about is the product assortment and delivery mechanisms. So going back to that loving smell, this is still the number one thing. And, we can't retrain ourselves overnight. It's still one of those signals that I feel it's just going to be hard for most people to overcome. And having an ability to have different ways to consume cannabis and it be more efficient, more bioavailability, all of the good things around science that help with not just patient, but better manufacturing for consumer products, I think we're going to start to see more of that proliferate. I see it in pockets in some markets, but I would love to see it more globally.
Also, the smell, even the smell, I know that they're trying to develop, and maybe they have developed this smellless weed that doesn't smell like marijuana, doesn't smell like cannabis, you know, like, so you can, I've heard tell, I know, who knows what you have to do to take the smell away.
I mean, well, the smell is from terpenes, and the honest truth is part of that aromatic experience is participating in involving your endocannabinoid system. So it's like, if you don't know that, you're like, oh, but we just want to, you know, solve for a problem, you may be creating another problem, which may be more ineffective cannabis, because the truth is the terpenes help with the effectiveness. So it's sort of odd. I agree with it, right? I'm one of probably the target market, but I would rather look at accessories. So I have like a Urbana, which is a smell proof bag. And rather than change the plant, I'm looking for ways to take other things that we change all the time, like a purse, and transform it to suit what the plant needs.
Well, Deshita Dawson, this has been absolutely fascinating. I hope I can bring you back in a few months to see how it's going and all the different ways that you're changing the cannabis industry up in Oregon. Such a great opportunity for you and for that city. So congratulations again on the new job, and let's stay in touch. I hope you can still contribute to us. Are you allowed to write for us still?
I am.
Yay.
Very excited that I am. So yeah, no, I'll still be contributing as the thought arises. And I have plenty now that I've been thinking about already.
Yeah, I'm sure you've got a lot on your mind. You are in the front lines now. All right. Well, have a great rest of your day.
Thank you. You too.
Thank you for listening to the Green Entrepreneur Podcast. To find out more about Green Entrepreneur, you can go to greenentrepreneur.com or check out our magazine on newsstands everywhere. Check out our Instagram at Green Entrepreneur. We're also on Twitter, LinkedIn, Facebook, and all other social media feeds. If you like this podcast and you'd like to hear more from me, Jonathan Small, check out my other podcast, Write About Now, that's W-R-I-T-E, to get some in-depth interviews into the lives and stories of successful writers, how they got there, what they learned, and what you need to succeed. That's writeaboutnowmedia.com. Until next episode, we'll THC you later.